As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
The PLA sees warfare as being fundamentally transformed by initially information technology, now increasingly artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies, and there's a level of technological determinism that has arguably influenced China's overall military innovation in sort of seeing the application of these technologies of the era to warfare as inevitable, and initially trying to close what they saw as an era gap relative to the U.S. military, the sphere of being a generation behind in the critical technologies of warfare, to today, greater confidence that as we enter this new era of warfare, the PLA is closer to the same level at the starting point and has the potential, if it can anticipate the continued evolutions of technology and changing character of conflict, that there are ways to exploit these trends and design future warfare or design capabilities that could be decisive in future conflicts.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 47, China's Military Bet on the Future. One of the most consequential developments in global security today is the transformation of the People's Liberation Army. As the Chinese Communist Party drives to build a world-class military by 2049, the PLA is undergoing a sweeping reinvention. This shift is not just about fielding new platforms or weapons. It reflects a deeper fusion of political doctrine and cutting-edge technology, combining top-down party control with an ambition for greater operational agility. This episode isn't about hardware or parade day optics. It's about command. Who makes decisions, how fast, and with what tools. From cloud-based digital networks and AI-enabled decision aids to quantum sensors and autonomous systems, the PLA is betting it can leapfrog legacy systems and even legacy thinking. The goal? To compress decision cycles, accelerate action, and synchronize operations across all domains. Land, sea, air, cyber, and space, in ways that could challenge even the most advanced adversaries. At the center of this transformation is a concept the PLA calls intelligentization. This goes beyond traditional informationization by fusing automation, machine learning, and big data to reshape command and control. But the critical question is not just what China is building. It's how close the PLA is to turning these ambitions into a coherent, combat-ready force. Does China have a unified offset strategy, or just a patchwork of asymmetric capabilities? Are leap-ahead technologies like hypersonic glide vehicles, quantum navigation, and drone swarms mature enough to alter the Indo-Pacific balance of power? Can the PLA's joint theater reforms overcome persistent friction between the services and political leadership? And perhaps most critically, how resilient is China's command structure in the face of fast-moving multi-theater crises? To help unpack these questions, I'm joined today by Elsa Kenya. Elsa is a leading expert on China's military innovation and emerging technologies. Her research explores China's approach to defense modernization, command systems, and military-civil fusion. She's testified before U.S. congressional commissions, served as a Fulbright specialist in Australia, and has been named an official mad scientist by the U.S. Army's Training and Doctrine Command. Her work appears in Foreign Affairs, Defense One, and the Journal of Strategic Studies. And she's been quoted in New York Times, The Economist, The Washington Post, and more. She's currently a PhD candidate at Harvard and a visiting scholar with us here at DKI APCSS. Elsa's analysis is sharp, balanced, and deeply informed. She cuts through the hype to expose the friction points, bureaucratic resistance, political constraints, and operational limitations. Yet she also takes seriously the possibility that China's path to military modernization, though distinct from the U.S. model, may still produce disruptive capabilities. In today's conversation, we'll explore where the PLA is making real progress, where it still struggles, and what surprises might lie ahead if competition turns into conflict. Let's begin the dialogue. Elsa Cano, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this sit down for some time.
As have I.
Yeah. And so I want to begin where I usually do, and that is to ask a guest to tell us your story. Tell us how you came to be an expert in this field, maybe.
Well, I suppose my self-criticism, so to speak, would be I'm a perpetual student of this. I started focusing on China around 2013. I first spent the summer in Beijing with the Carnegie Tsinghua Center looking at Chinese ambitions and actions in the South China Sea. And certainly we've seen quite a dramatic change since then in our but both in terms of the creeping development of military infrastructure in the South China Sea and beyond, and how far the PLA has come, even just in just over a decade. So I see myself as a perpetual student of China and Chinese, and I'd sort of pivoted from looking more at U.S.-China relations generally to focusing on how emerging domains and frontier technologies can factor into this evolving competition.
Still, even though you started in 2013, what took you to China?
So I guess some of the backstory might be that as I had initially thought I wanted to study biology and chemistry, and have a longstanding interest and curiosity about science, but had also felt drawn to understand some of the challenges of U.S. foreign policy. And there is perhaps no greater challenge in the world today than U.S.-China relations. And I was also just fortunate to have a dear family friend who was a close influence on me, who was one of the first Americans to travel to China back in the 80s. And he had tea with Deng Xiaoping and saw a very different China in a very different era of U.S.-China relations. So always been curious with understanding both the risks and some of the openings in U.S.-China relations and how we balance a candid appreciation of the challenges with recognizing where there are still opportunities and indeed imperatives to sustain pragmatic cooperation.
You know, I think my last time in China was in the 90s, late 90s, and I was thinking about you talking about how things had changed since you had been there, but one of the big things is the fact that you went there and spent time on the ground and did that, and that is increasingly becoming harder to do for our experts.
It is definitely a challenging moment. I am tentatively optimistic about the prospects for academic exchange. I actually just returned from 2 weeks in Beijing as a fellow with the Penn Project on the Future of U.S.-China Relations and had a series of meetings with party and government officials, as well as a workshop at Tsinghua University and a series of meetings where we talked about everything from cross-strait relations to artificial intelligence. And it was, I think I was tentatively encouraged by the fact that we were able to have this academic exchange and dialogue and relatively candid and even on some of the toughest and most sensitive issues today. So I'm cognizant of the complexities, but committed to continuing to maintain this kind of dialogue and working relationships with Chinese colleagues and counterparts, because I think the stakes are too high not to engage or not to have candid communication on some of these tough questions.
No, you're absolutely correct. Well, that's thanks for sharing that and your most recent experience in there. And I'd be interested to pull on that maybe as we're talking through some of these questions. But let's kind of start with asking about digital command. You know, the PLA is embedding cloud-based technology in its networks, its theater-wide data fusions, its AI-assisted decisions tools. All this to compress the OODA loop, right? It is observe, orient, decide, act. How it goes from observe to act as fast as it can. So here's a question then. How is this evolving digital command infrastructure shaping the PLA's decision speed, adaptability, and responsiveness in combat?
A great question, but a tough one. And I think the PLA's efforts here are very much a work in progress and in some respects untested. But we have seen really a dramatic transformation, a revolution, so to speak, in Chinese command capabilities since the earliest command automation efforts in the starting in the 1970s, when the PLA was just trying to get basic computing technology integrated into its armed forces, to today, when there's a lot of experimentation with moving to the cloud, with AI-enabled decision support systems. And we've seen over time a degree of consistency in the scientific thinking on command and the PLA's efforts to combine a traditional emphasis on the human element in warfare that can trace back to Mao's thinking on sort of people as a critical factor and the importance of subjective initiative and sort of line with traditional Marxist concepts to some extent, relative to the sort of scientific and systems thinking that emerged in the PLA with Chan Shui-sen, most known as a father of China's nuclear program, but also having major influence on how the PLA approaches military science and thinks about warfare as scientific. So I think the interplay between these influences, the focus on the human or political element of warfare with the scientific, has really been a driving factor and a consistent emphasis over time. And starting under Deng Xiaoping, the PLA recognized that they had to undergo dramatic reforms. And as they watched the US pursue Goldwater Nichols, as they watched Russian military reforms, as they saw in the 1990s under Jiang Zemin, the Gulf War and US advances in information technology, they sort of consistently pursued advances in information technologies and started to recognize information as an ever more critical element of warfare, the informatization agenda you alluded to in your introduction. And that really created a foundation of developing more robust command automation systems, essentially C3, command information systems, C4ISR, and now a focus on more complex network information systems that sort of C5ISR and beyond, with supported by a very robust communications infrastructure, extensive ISR architectures, really a focus on resilience and placing information at the center of their theory of victory. And today, as we've seen in the past nearly a decade now, thinking starts to evolve in the direction of intelligentization. And the ization here really sort of conveys the notion of transformation, that the PLA sees warfare as being fundamentally transformed by initially information technology, now increasingly artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies. And there's a level of technological determinism that has arguably influenced China's overall military innovation in sort of seeing the application of these t of the technologies of the era to warfare as inevitable. And initially trying to close what they saw as an air gap relative to the US military, this fear of being a generation behind in the critical technologies of warfare, to today, greater confidence that as we enter this new era of warfare, the PLA is closer to the same level at the starting point and has the potential, if it can anticipate the continued evolutions of technology and changing character of conflict, that there are ways to exploit these trends and design future warfare or design capabilities that could be decisive in future conflicts. So we've sort of seen this relative reactivity to looking to the US as a powerful adversary, learning from the US military, trying to catch up, and now essentially greater confidence that the ambition to leapfrog or overtake the US military is closer to within reach, even as there's still anxieties about ongoing US advances that could again reestablish or bolster American relative technological dominance.
That was a fascinating overview. Made me reflect on some of my own earlier times. The introduction of computers into the artillery, for example. We had, the 70s, early 80s, they had FADAC computer systems. They went to TACFIRE and they went to BCS. And this was difficult even in those days to put people's, it was this black box syndrome. It was in there. There was a lack of a trust for the systems. And I know that whether we're talking about Chinese systems or American systems, that there is this cultural evolution that has to occur within people to pull into the where modernity is taking us in this field. You've written quite a bit about this, and no, definitely fascinating. Let's talk a minute about the joint theater. since its 2016 reforms, which were really quite significant. China has it's aimed to integrate its land, its sea, its air, its cyber, its space forces under a unified joint warfighting command. Let me ask you this. What tangible progress and lingering frictions characterize the PLA's efforts to conduct full integrated joint operations across these domains?
So the PLA started thinking about jointness back in the 80s and 90s when they were observing US and then Soviet efforts in this regard, but it really took some decades of experimentation, of incremental advancement to reach the point where the PLA is today, where they've taken the theater command or war zone, which was once a wartime command structure, and made it a fully standing, quite functional organization in peacetime, with joint operations command centers that are manned and really integrating across peacetime and wartime contingencies in their training and approaches. A lot of efforts along the way to cultivate joint personnel, to build that sort of human element as an enabler of this kind of command and to overcome the prior frictions between services in a system in which the Army had once been quite dominant. But now I think we can see the advancement in terms of the maturation of these theater commands over the past nearly a decade at this point, and taking what had once been only extant in wartime into a more routine construct. And we can see with, for instance, the Eastern Theater Command and its role in ongoing pressure operations around Taiwan, how far they've come in operationalizing that and having the capacity for more centralized coordination across services, across domains with greater sophistication. So I think that there are reasons, I think, to recognize the extent of the PLA's progress and to expect continued challenges, especially with that human element, but also to appreciate how far they've come. And the fact that these theater commands, analogous to a U.S. Joint Task Force in a sense, are the structures that would be aligned to a certain strategic direction in wartime and are aligned to specific scenarios. So a core concept for these reforms has been a more seamless transition from peacetime competition into contingency or sort of full wartime mobilization, and having more consistency in structures, greater integration of the mobilization system, for instance, has been another core element of the reforms. And this does improve overall readiness, as does the posturing around Taiwan, the consistent presence of the PLA Navy, the consistent pressures from the PLA Air Force, and in ways that I think do both, whether we call it gray zone or sort of this new doctrine of peacetime employment of military forces that Xi Jinping has been advancing, the use of military pressure and the consistency of that posture does give the PLA a greater level of readiness that they've been able to maintain and surge when they're seeking to exercise that pressure. But certainly it does have implications for warning, and it does, I think, highlight the extent of their advancement in quite a short time from a force that was once dismissed and is now seen as a near peer and in some respects more imminent as a threat, given that question of intentions as well.
Yeah, I mean, so 9 years, right, since 2016, and going joint is a tough transformation for anyone. The United States, and you're right, it was in the 80s, and we'll pull on that and talk about it. But I think five theater commands, right? So you've got the North Theater Command, which looks over the Korean Peninsula and Russia, probably then the East, Taiwan, South mm-hmm. for South China Sea, the West, the India mm-hmm. Border, and then I guess the Central mm-hmm. for strategic reserves. And mm-hmm. and you say they're struggling still, which I'd imagine they are, with a little bit of inter-service rivalries or challenges that as they're going through that. I mean, if I understood you right, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, the Eastern Theater Command is the priority direction, followed by the Southern. Right. And yeah, there's definitely some indications, and the PLA often quite openly critiques itself, that jointness is a work in progress. Yes. They are still cultivating that and continuing to reform their military education and training system overall to improve that. But I think Couple unique features that are seen as enabling that jointness is the creation of some of these support forces, the Information Support Force and Joint Logistics Support Force. And the Information Support Force in particular is interesting. We don't have a direct equivalent in a US context, and its establishment and building up from what was formerly a component of the Strategic Support Force, I think, is significant as an indication of just how pivotal Chinese leaders believe operationalizing information is in warfare. Information support to targeting and intelligence support to decision making, the criticality of communications to command. And I think it's definitely a new element of the PLA that is still under construction since it was formally established in April of 2024. But I think the evolution of the PLA structure highlights the lessons they've learned from their close study of the US military, but also some of these more unique elements in terms of how they see warfare and how they're organizing and preparing for future contingencies.
Let's pull on this intelligent warfare. We've talked around it a few times. You brought it up a couple of times. I mean, China sees this intelligentized warfare enabled by AI, autonomy, machine learning, big data. I mean, they see this as the next frontier beyond the informationized conflict. So, informationized conflict where we are now, as I understand it, and then the intelligent ized warfare is something they're going towards. So here's the question: where is the PLA making these measurable, its measurable progress in applying this AI to command and control? And where does official rhetoric maybe exceed the actual capabilities that they have?
So I'd say that some of the near-term feasible and pragmatic applications of AI tools are in intelligence, in a more effective, faster processing of massive amounts of data, really enabling their ISR capabilities and kill chain to be much faster, more seamless, a greater automation, including edge processing. So for instance, there are Chinese startups advertising AI-enabled space systems, both for space operations and the processing of spatial intelligence. So that definitely can accelerate kill chains and accelerate decision making when you don't have human necessarily as a slowing factor for some of that processing of data at scale and speed. Also, a lot of interest in using AI to enable cyber operations. And I think some of these virtual domains that have information, cyberspace, electronic warfare are frontiers in which AI could have particular scope of play in the near to midterm. And the PLA appears to be actively experimenting, procuring tools that are commercially available, working in research on research and development within military institutions, and focusing on not only the sort of information operations component of this, how to advance their capabilities to target and undercut adversary decision making, but also in addition to intelligence, greater tools for decision support, whether that's weapons target pairing or use of AI tools to generate potential courses of action and support the overall planning process. There's interest in the use of large language models in that context, and that both work within PLA research institutions like their Academy of Military Science or National University of Defense Technology, as well as some startups and commercial enterprises that are developing these tools and marketing them to the PLA and advertising their capabilities aligned with China's military civil fusion strategy, which is sought to leverage and to create a more integrated ecosystem. So there is a degree of military futurism in the PLA's thinking, sometimes far-fetched imaginations of what future warfare could entail, but there also are quite pragmatic, practical approaches to starting to leverage some of these tools for just some of the baseline data processing that is really foundational to modern military operations.
Fascinating. I want to pull on something we spoke about a little bit earlier, which was this leapfrog or leap ahead technology. So China is investing heavily in disruptive technologies, such as quantum sensing, hypersonic glide vehicles, and autonomous swarm, and certainly others. And they're doing this to be able to outmaneuver traditional U.S. advantages, right? So here's the question: what of these leapfrog technologies has the greatest potential to shift the military balance here in the Indo-Pacific, let's say, in the next 5 years or so?
Let's see. And I think that certainly in the near term, the PLA's advances in unmanned systems are significant. I'd say that hypersonics are perhaps decisive in some respects as well, and we've seen some of those systems deployed and implemented. But I think when it comes to when it comes to sort of unique niches and areas where I think we'll continue to see near-term applications, including in this space of military struggle between peace and warfare, the PLA's ability to manufacture at scale and start to operationalize unmanned systems is significant, as are is their interest in swarm intelligence. And there's some interesting intersections, for instance, between unmanned systems, autonomy, and hypersonics, the idea of swarms of hypersonic systems, for instance, a lot of capabilities that may sound fantastical, but that the PLA is actively pursuing and experimenting with. So I think that while we've seen in a US context Replicator and other initiatives to try to, and including some of Secretary Hegseth's recent emphasis on drone technology and trying to close that gap, I think there are reasons to be concerned that the PLA has such a tremendous capacity for manufacturing such a wide-ranging and extensive drone industry. And looking just to that specific niche, I think that it will certainly be a challenge and a dimension of the military competition where the balance may be tilting in China's favor, or certainly there is a greater challenge than the US military is accustomed to facing in terms of these frontier capabilities, just given the sheer scale of what China's doing in terms of embracing unmanned systems and autonomy as sort of pragmatic capabilities across all domains and all services today.
I mean, you mentioned about the their advances in drone warfare, and as I understand, I mean, globally they produce more drones than anyone else. In fact, frankly, maybe more than all others combined. It is really at a significant level. Is that would you?
And
Would,
I'd say that's true whether we're looking at commercial industry, at DJI and their
yes.
dominance in the drone market, or even the export of unmanned systems for military applications to a growing number of militaries worldwide.
Yeah.
And remember, a couple of years back, there used to be some skepticism that Chinese drone exports were just cheap knockoffs of
Right.
US systems, that they, a couple of incidents where one may have crashed or been unsatisfactory to the military that purchased it, but we've seen, I think, a great degree of learning and progression, including learning informed by how their systems are performing when they're in service with other militaries around the world. So I think we've definitely seen a dramatic expansion of these exports and the profits and the experience gained from that kind of export market is also feeding back into improving their overall design and manufacturing of military unmanned systems.
Fascinating. Let me ask you about this offset playbook. Chinese military thinkers, for some time now, actually, have been emphasizing this offset strategy that exploits asymmetry to delay, degrade, or and even deter the U.S.'s power projection. And so here's the question: does China have a coherent offset strategy that's anchored in a unified theory of deterrence, or is it a more eclectic collection of just these asymmetric tools without actually a strategic cohesion? How would you characterize it?
It's a great question. I guess I'd say that both to some extent. I do
Probably.
think that there is a fairly flexible, opportunistic willingness to place bets on different disruptive technologies and capabilities, and often to sustain these bets over time. Even for technologies and systems such as directed energy, where in a US context, we may have seen some programs progress, run into roadblocks, and not be sustained. In a Chinese context, there's been often a fair amount of continuity in pursuing long-term advancements in technologies believed to be potentially influential for the future of warfare. So I think there's sort of been a fairly diversified portfolio of military research and development and of investments and a degree of patience apparently in sustaining some of the funding and programming to long enough duration to see some of these capabilities start to mature, as for instance has been the case with some of their advances in directed energy and the like. And I think there's also a focus on, at the strategic level, on thinking about an offset strategy and technologies as an element of their overall approach to counterintervention, as we've seen with capabilities within the PLA Rocket Force and their recognition that that land-based missiles can be a very effective counterintervention capability when the U.S. is focusing on power projection into the region with naval power. And so I think there's been some consistent themes over time. And really in the past, if we look back a decade or so to the U.S. launch of the third offset strategy, in that time frame, the PLA appeared to be determined not to let itself be offset and to keep pace and match some of those same technologies and even to learn from or emulate U.S. programs in some respects, trying to see if it could get there first with some of the capabilities we'd identified as decisive. And if we look further back in greater sweep to the 1990s, to the Third Taiwan Strait Crisis, for instance, and their frustration and perception that the U.S. was the primary obstacle in the context of cross-strait relations or the primary deterrent, or even to the Belgrade embassy bombing in May of 1999, which had prompted Jiang Zemin to launch the 995 program, as has been publicly discussed and documented, to some extent, the notion that the capabilities that the U.S. military could be fearful of are the ones that the PLA must develop. So I think we can see this focus on offsetting or developing asymmetric capabilities as a consistent theme, whether we're looking over the past decade or back further to some of those earlier pivotal moments that made the PLA recognize that they needed effective countermeasures to counterbalance or achieve counterintervention relative to U.S. military power. So looking at some of the weaknesses of U.S. ways of warfare, including our dependence on RC4ISR, that certainly was a driver for China's development of cyber and electronic warfare capabilities in the decades since. So I guess in response to your excellent question, I think it's been a bit of both. There's been this sort of flexibility and opportunism and betting on technologies and seeing what pans out, but then this consistent overarching emphasis on seeking capabilities that could cause the U.S. military to pause or seeking to deter U.S. presence and operations in the region for the long term.
As you were talking, I was thinking about, I actually think, so the first offset was nuclear weapons, right? And that today is July 16th, which means it's the 80th anniversary of the first nuclear test done by the United States in deserts of New Mexico, right? And so there's 80 years for you. And so we've had a few since, and you clearly brought about the 90s about precision munitions and stealth and those types of things. And you also, one of my favorite things is usually it's not this or that, but a little combination of both. And you rightly noted that in your response. So let me ask you about capability reality. So not all of China's touted platforms, its drone swarms, its aircraft carriers, its space-based assets, I mean, they're not all fully mature or operational at scale. So how can outside observers distinguish between PLA systems that are combat ready and those that remain perhaps developmental, aspirational, or even performative in nature?
So I guess I'd say there can be a level of hype sometimes in characterization of Chinese emerging military capabilities. And I think it's important not to underestimate the PLA's progress and advances, but also not
I've
to
been
get
in many meetings where that has been the case, right?
Indeed.
Where they're just like, oh, there's nothing there. I'm like, there's nothing there? But continue, please.
Yeah, so I think there's been one of the interesting things in working on these topics for nearly a decade at this point is to see how the conversation can shift from that underestimation or dismissal or the idea that China can't innovate or is merely a copycat, which still to this day persists in some circles or contexts, relative to the more hyperbolic characterizations or arguments that China has already beat us in all of these critical domains of military technology or capabilities and that we are severely disadvantaged. And the reality is always somewhere in the middle.
That's what I like to say.
And where exactly in the middle depends on which domain, which technology, which specific capability. And I think it's important to sort of be grounded in sort of most accurate information available. And there's some very, very good reports put out China Maritime Studies Institute at the Naval War College, for instance, has been fantastic documentation of Chinese naval power and capabilities over time, and to leverage the full range of open source resources to understand the relationship between our understanding of Chinese military strategy, concepts of operations, the capabilities developed, and how these are starting to be demonstrated in training. For those of us who look at the PLA in the open source, we're inherently dependent on information the PLA produces about itself in military newspapers, journal articles, and the like. And there can, of course, be some biases in those sources, but I think for the most part, there is sometimes a surprising degree of candor as well in terms of self-criticisms of their challenges, the steps they're taking to overcoming them. And I think so I think we can have some confidence just looking at the open source holistically, looking at the totality of information available, cross-referencing with China Military Power Report, for instance, produced and released through the Pentagon, and tracking these trends over time and recognizing the consistent progression across a number of these domains and capabilities. I think there are reasons to take quite seriously the capabilities we've seen fielded, exercised, demonstrated. Where I think the reasons for more skepticism are more of the sort of the tendency towards hype, especially in some media reporting, that a lot of claims that can sometimes capture headlines. The idea of sort of and a couple stories have been rather hyperbolic around sort of claims that a system that is merely a prototype, for instance, for cutting deep sea cables is actually a fully fledged capability. So I think it's important to look beyond the headlines, look at the sourcing, look at the totality of the patterns of research, development, experimentation, and operationalization, and recognize where we've seen those advances over time, and we can have some confidence in the relative credibility of capabilities based on that pattern of facts. I think always reasons to be skeptical. For instance, some of the claims about advances in quantum radar that were reportedly demonstrated a couple of years back, most scientists I spoke to at the time were not convinced that particular technique could be all that viable in a more contested environment. But some of the more recent reports of advances in quantum sensing, both in a US and Chinese context, do appear to be more viable. So I think this is also an area where it's very important for those of us like myself or social scientists who don't have a deep technical background to engage as much as possible with scientists, technologists, and operators to try to understand what is viable based on the science and the laws of physics, and to try to differentiate also sort of the underlying research and development that makes a certain capability appear more likely or more mature relative to sometimes claims that can be promulgated or propagandized that are based on sometimes more limited reporting and open source evidence.
Nicely said. I want to take the conversation a little bit into crisis scenarios. And so contingencies in Taiwan, the South China Sea, along the Indian border, I mean, each place unique stresses on China's command systems. So here's the question then. How resilient is the PLA's command and control architecture under the strains of these, simultaneous high tempo crises across multiple theaters?
So I'd say from a technical perspective, there is a great deal of resilience, and that is resilience by design.
Okay.
The development of very extensive ground-based communications infrastructure augmented by space-based communications and extensive leveraging of fiber optic cables and networks that the Information Support Force, for instance, is responsibility for repairing, and a focus on sort of multiple systems and networks across domains, really the system of systems approach to command and to overall warfighting. I think from a technical perspective, there are likely still vulnerabilities, and certainly China's cybersecurity traditionally has been uneven sometimes, and there's always the potential for human error in terms of any system or network and its overall resilience. But I think when it comes to the human element of decision-making at the strategic level, there are some reasons to question the overall capacity. And I think that does, especially in a situation where there could be multiple crises or situations simultaneously, the PLA does have a relatively centralized approach to command at the theater or campaign level in terms of recognizing the imperative of coordination and synchronization, There's a greater willingness to decentralize at more tactical levels when it comes to specific operational scenarios where there's recognized a need to for more flexibility and initiative. But when it comes to strategic decision making, the buck stops with Xi Jinping. And I think that the fact that for all of the AI-enabled decision support tools, for all of the focus on cultivating grassroots commanders of initiative in certain ta limited tactical contexts, if it comes to strategic choices, at least our understanding at the CMC level, Xi Jinping is the final and ultimate decision maker. So I'd imagine that if there were to be multiple contingencies occurring simultaneously for which strategic decisions needed to be made in real time, there would be a certain human limitation there. And that does come down to that question of political control and the extent to which Xi Jinping has centralized power and made himself the indispensable decision maker on any number of issues. So that'll be something to watch over time in terms of especially uncertainty about the duration of his tenure in power, scenarios for succession at some point in the future, and sort of what the dynamics look like within the party and in party-army relations in terms of some of those more sensitive strategic or political decision making.
My experience has been it is a crisis that forces a necessity to make a change. And so perhaps we won't really see the way they, a need to power down until there's a need to power down. And if there's single crises that can be handled at a top level, there's probably going to continue to flow in that direction. And so we'll watch this space and see if there are multiple crises that require this type of agility that we're talking about. Let's talk about strategic surprise. Historically, militaries have revealed disruptive capabilities in wartime that's caught the adversary off guard. One that comes to mind real quickly for me is the Germans' use of Blitzkrieg at the onset of the Second World War is an example of that. China may aim for similar effects as well. So the question is this: if hostilities erupted tomorrow, what command and control driven or tech-enabled surprises from the PLA might most upend U.S. operational assumptions that we have right now? Any thoughts?
So I hope that this particular capability or threat wouldn't be a surprise given news and recent events, but I think the extent to which Chinese cyberspace operators appear to be penetrating U.S. critical infrastructure and critical networks, both military and civilian, as was seen with the reporting on Vol Typhoon, I think is something where that sort of capability and contingency should not be a surprise given what's already been detected and exposed. But I worry sometimes that we still may underestimate the extent to which Chinese strategists view the cyber domain as really eroding boundaries between the front line and the home front. And I think we're used to thinking of the US homeland as a sanctuary, and we're used to feeling quite secure. And I think in a world where cyber threats don't respect borders or boundaries, I think the challenges are much more acute. So that is perhaps one of the less surprising surprises that I worry we may, where I think the threats are very clear and very consistent with how Chinese strategists have discussed wanting to conduct cyber operations going back to the early 2000s. And now they're developing the capabilities as they expand the cyberspace force to actually realize and operationalize those concepts and to present those threats in ways that could be I think require a more coordinated response and greater degree of resilience across the U.S. whole of government and whole of society than we are accustomed to having to muster. So that's one of the first that comes to mind. I think another would be along the lines of advances in quantum computing, for instance, and with quantum machine learning, with greater computing capability coming into play. I mean, there has been for quite some time now a call to move towards a post-quantum or quantum-proof, essentially, encryption, but I think there's still not necessarily an appreciation for the fact that China's closed the gap with the US in quantum computing, far more quickly than realized. And I think that does open up some possibilities in terms of code breaking, in terms of any other military applications for which massive computing capability could provide a premium. And biotechnology, I think, is another domain where there's a lot of risk or potential for surprise based on perhaps different parameters in play in terms of what scientists are willing to consider developing and what could be brought into play, though that does get into some more speculative scenarios.
As you're talking, I'm thinking we could have an entire episode talking about this type of technologies, whether we're talking about quantum navigation or we're talking about, I mean, you mentioned biotechnologies, but oh my goodness, the thoughts of creating super soldiers or all types of different things that are being looked at could be real game changers if employed, right? We have, oh my goodness, we had well over a couple hundred people who registered for today's episode, and so plethora of audience questions. I want to try to go through just a few of those in our remaining time. This first one's asking us about AI's next frontier. So, what is the significance of frontier advances in AI and ultimately the potential realization of AGI in advancing the capabilities of the PLA?
So, Chinese researchers are actively pursuing AGI and ASI, and the PLA appears to be relatively pragmatic in exploring how these sorts of technologies could be integrated into decision making. I think there is a consistent focus on the human element and notions of human-machine integration or a hybrid approach to intelligence, but there does appear to be a lot of interest in how AI could support not only command decision making, but strategic decision making. And some of this we can even trace back to the PLA's initial response to AlphaGo, and the idea that if an AI agent can defeat human strategists in a game based on sort of superior moves and stratagems, what could the implications be on the future battlefield? And of course, there's a long way between a game or a war game and an actual combat scenario, but there appears to be a lot of interest in exploring how to integrate AI into decision making from the simpler, more near-term applications we discussed, improved processing of intelligence to accelerate command decision making, but in the long term, as AGI becomes more mature, I would imagine and anticipate that those applications could continue to deepen and that there also could be more integration of AI-enabled tools and techniques into other elements of decision making, and including in the context of attempts to achieve surprise, to realize deception, to come up with novel stratagems that adversaries may not anticipate. So definitely, I think something to keep an eye on, and certainly many civilian and commercial applications for advances in AI, a very robust and diverse AI industry in China, the economic importance and implications of AI in general and progress towards AGI particularly will perhaps be equally, if not more, significant to national power going forward. But I think the interest in the military applications will certainly be a feature, especially given the extent to which Chinese strategists see this as inherently a dual use capability.
Well, I want to pull on what you were talking about and go to this next question, which is asking about AI platforms in use. So, can you discuss what AI platforms and applications are being developed and introduced in China?
So I think I've d alluded to this a little bit earlier and want to make sure we get to as many questions as possible, but there's been a lot of focus on use of large language models for intelligence, to support planning, natural language processing, including potentially to enable propaganda and information operations. So I think we can expect to see the cyberspace force as one of the major users of these tools, and that's consistent with some of the development and procurement in play. A lot of initial exploration of integration of AI into space systems as well, both for information processing and overall operations, and yeah, a lot of AI tools in wargaming as well. One particular tool called Warskull was initially developed as a tool for wargaming competition and then reportedly was later deployed to a number of military units, including at the theater command level. So it's definitely sometimes the information publicly available is different levels of generality or capacity to confirm full extent of advances or integration, but definitely quite a range of different tools and systems that are either under development or at some stage of deployment at this point.
Fascinating. You spoke a little bit about drones earlier, so but this question is asking about a drone capability comparison between the U.S. and Chinese drone warfighting capabilities, both current and future trajectories. How would they compare? How do you see this?
So I think as China's capacity and diversity of their drone industry in terms of some of the military drones under development is definitely a strength. I think for in a US context, it is tentatively encouraging to see the extent of progress through Replicator, as well as some of the recent initiatives announced by the current Secretary of Defense. So I think we're definitely starting to compete more actively and starting to embrace drone technology and these capabilities more aggressively than we had been in the past. I think the PLA had previously perhaps demonstrated greater enthusiasm and greater creativity in some respects in terms of developing a range of diversity of systems. So I think it's going to be continue to be an active domain of the competition going forward in terms of how we see these capabilities coming online, especially with greater autonomy and exploration of swarming and swarm intelligence, seeing mass really be a critical factor in warfare. And I think the ability to deploy that mass and those attritable systems is something where Chinese industry has certain strengths. And we've seen, for instance, their Agile Innovation Defense Unit, their response to the Defense Innovation Unit, initially set up in Shenzhen, be one factor or one enabler there. And I think overall strategy of military civil fusion focused on these sorts of critical emerging industries is really providing some systemic strengths in this dimension of the competition.
When I think about my own personal experience in the I guess early mid 80s, the U.S. Army was using drone, but it was kind of testing their abilities, and they were fairly rudimentary. Or even my responsibilities in training, equipping, and advising Afghan National Security Forces during that period, and the number of drones we sent out there. It took a long time to get from those 2 points. And yet, when you think about, you brought about current wars going on, and you think about wars going on in Ukraine, and the surge of drones in this warfare, and their use, and how they are making a massive difference on the battlefield. Your earlier comments about DJI and their leading position in the field in this area here. This would be an area not to underestimate, I think, where China currently is with its drone capabilities.
Certainly. And unsurprisingly, the PLA is actively looking to and learning from Ukraine and starting to experiment with how to integrate unmanned systems more extensively. And I think sometimes in a US context, there appeared to be some resistance historically to how some of these systems could displace manned platforms. But in the PLA, there appears to be quite a great degree of enthusiasm and a perception that these are the future of warfare and these are capabilities that need to be prioritized, not just for counterterrorism scenarios, as had shaped a lot of the US initial employment of unmanned systems, but focusing on drones for more high-end warfighting. I remember I visited the Chinese Military Museum back in 2019, and there was a small display on the wall that showed a series of drone swarms going up against an aircraft carrier. Did not specify whose aircraft carrier that might be, but one can imagine. And that was more aspirational at the time than but we've since seen continued demonstrations of swarms from the Chinese defense industry and research on swarm intelligence from Chinese military scientists. So I think we're starting to see some of the PLA's ambitions become more feasible given the sorts of capabilities that are closer to coming online, if not already deployed.
Let's go to this next question. It's asking about influence and strategy. So could you discuss the Chinese military role in foreign information manipulation and interference, the FIMI operations, and how these capabilities, frankly, are integrated with the broader military strategy?
The PLA has a long history of political warfare or wartime political work dating back to the Chinese Civil War. And I think a lot of those the lessons learned from that conflict about the importance of trying to undermine and subvert enemy forces have carried through to the present and resulted in a quite consistent emphasis on psychological warfare, a lot of attention and concern in a U.S. context sometimes to the three warfares
Yes,
that
I
I
was
think
thinking about
what's
that.
that emerged from their former general political department. And one of the changes that several of us watching these issues regarded as quite significant is when the element of the PLA that has traditionally been responsible for a lot of this, three warfares or especially psychological warfare, was actually integrated into the former Strategic Support Force, now likely within the Cyberspace Force, which corresponded with the emergence of a concept of cognitive domain operations, which has really emphasized taking more traditional elements of psychological or political warfare and bringing them into the internet age or as operations in social media, in cyberspace, and trying to experiment with new tools and techniques for influence and interference. Seen sometimes limited effects or limited efficacy, apparently, and for instance, attempted interference against Taiwan. But I think one trend to watch for will be the extent to which generative artificial intelligence, as applied to influence and interference, can enable the PLA and China's party state actors and across their ecosystem writ large to be more effective and more targeted in how they approach psychological warfare and whether new types of content and messaging, greater understanding of target audiences, and more precisely targeted content. I think there's reasons for concern that some of the clumsiness of prior attempts could be overcome as they start to have greater amounts of data to process and to inform the design of new campaigns going forward. So definitely, I think an area where some of the history and some of the technology could converge in ways that could be concerning, especially given the extent to which data is readily exposed and exploited, and that can create certain vulnerabilities as well.
Well said. Let's take two more questions and we'll go quick because we are short on time. But the first one's asking about warfare in the shadows. And it's kind of, how is the PLA combining the cognitive, the information, and the biotechnology and warfare operations in the strategy, the combination of those?
So the PLA or certain PLA strategists have expressed enthusiasm for sort of non-lethal capabilities, for weaponization of biotechnology, for techniques to target enemy cognition, and reasons for concern that with some of the military medical science and research underway, some of those concepts could eventually be tested or realized. Definitely, I think a lot of, don't want to get too much into the realm of speculation there, but there's a lot of interest in the idea of sort of targeting the human mind, about brain weapons or sort of brain control. And so, some of this, again, is very much in the realm of military theorists writing speculatively about future capabilities, but with new technologies, with advances in neuroscience, biotechnology, weaponization of certain aspects of biology, against the backdrop of some of the traditional concerns about China's outlook on biological weapons and a some dimensions of military research that have provoked concerns in the past. I think reasons to watch that space, and I think hopefully to have pragmatic dialogue about some level of restraint or conveying of red lines in terms of future capabilities the PLA has openly contemplated, but hopefully would not bring to bear.
There's a last question. This is an area you know very well, military civil fusion engine. So drawing parallels with the entities like, the US's Defense Innovative Unit, Unit X, and how effectively is PLA leveraging China's civilian innovation clusters, such as Huawei, DJI, which you spoke about, and other clusters through its military civil fusion strategy? What would you say?
So I'd say that the initial elevation of military civil fusion as national strategy was to some extent an attempt to solve a problem. The PLA did not believe it had adequate capacity initially to leverage commercial technologies at scale. We've seen through a range of these initiatives, incentives, and mechanisms, greater attempts and greater success in enabling new startups and emerging enterprises to sell to the PLA, giving the PLA access to some of these emerging innovations. So I think we've seen both progress in some of these specific industries, whether that's cybersecurity, robotics, artificial intelligence, but also the creation of a more integrated overall ecosystem, whether that's the creation of militias and bringing more civilian forces into play, the talent dimension of military-civil fusion, or creating more dual-purpose research and development within the overall innovation ecosystem. So definitely a space to watch where the some aspects of the U.S. approach to defense innovation that have traditionally been quite successful, such as many of DARPA's programs and our overall history of robust partnerships between science, industry, and defense, so the PLAs look to and learn from and sought to bring into play similar systems and capabilities within the framework of the strategy.
Well said. This has been an amazing hour together. I have really learned a lot just talking with you. But before I let you go, I like to ask guests for a book recommendation. So maybe there's something you're reading or something you'd recommend to the audience.
Let's see. So I'm about to start reading and reviewing Dr. Fiona Cunningham's Under the Nuclear Shadow, which looks at the evolution of Chinese force posture in terms of nuclear space and cyberspace capabilities. And I'm excited to read that. And I know Fiona's research is fantastic, so I definitely recommend it to the audience as well.
Good recommendation. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. As we conclude today's dialogue, we've explored China's sweeping military transformation from its pursuit of cutting-edge digital command and AI to its push for joint theater integration and intelligentized warfare. This episode has challenged us to critically assess the actual readiness of the PLA's leap-ahead technologies and the coherence or fragmentation of its offset strategies in the face of future crisis and, frankly, potential conflict. These conversations shape security. Join us on July 28th when I sit down with Rachel Min-Young Lee from the Stimson Center. We'll talk. She's a leading expert on North Korea, and we'll sit down for episode 48, North Korea's Russia-China Play. We'll unpack Pyongyang's evolving alignment with Moscow and Beijing, and explore the economic, diplomatic, and security implications across the region. On behalf of all of us at DKIA PCSS, thank you for being part of this important dialogue. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKIA PCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.